gone out, Jeff, has it? I must have missed that.
Aguero! I see it, but I don't believe it!
That is a disgusting act by Randy Moss.
No.
Horacio Fantasia!
One last roll of the dice for Leo! Leo Barry, you star!
I know he's your captain, but you can't seriously lock him as a one.
Right in front of me! Right in front of me!
We look at the stories behind the scoreboard. As always, I'm Charles Goodsir, and with me today is fellow after student and good mate of mine, Tom Reeve.
Hello, how's it going?
Yeah, really great, Tom. We've been in lockdown, but it's meant that we've been able to watch a lot of sport over the past 2 months now. We've had a lot.
It's been about 2 months, yeah.
Yeah, we've had State of Origin, we've had the NBA Finals, the Olympics are currently on. It's the last day
yep.
as we're recording this. I watched the marathon this morning, one of all-time favourite events. But most notably, Tom, what did we have during the break?
Something that I would prefer to forget, unfortunately. Well, maybe not, because a great achievement by the England national team. But we had the Euros, and it was a fantastic tournament. England losing in the final, unfortunately, heartbreakingly. But that was great. That was, a real staple for me. I really watched at least a game a day. What a tournament.
England, they did lose, as they've been known to do. And that's what we're going to discuss today. Really heartbreaking losses. Losing sucks. I hate losing. Those who know me best know that I'm ultra competitive and I'll do anything to get a win. There are so many examples in sporting history of really heartbreaking losses that it was really hard for me just to choose the one. So we're going to do something a little bit different. We're going to spice it up here. We're going to tell three mini stories. And then you and I, Tom, are going to decide at the end which is the worst loss. What do you reckon?
Let's do it. Sounds great.
Here comes Mahomes. Trying to find the end zone, and no, how about that? One last indignity.
It's the 1990 NFL season, and the Buffalo Bills are in their first ever Super Bowl. They face off against the New York Giants.
Right.
The Bills were favorites coming into that game. They were by far and away the best team that year. And so New York's tactic was to starve the Bills of possession. So not let them have the ball, make sure to run a lot of plays, don't get up in the air. Be just like make it a really grinding slog of a game. And it worked. So with 8 seconds remaining in the game, New York are leading 20-19. And it's been back and forth all night.
Okay.
It's one of the classic games in Super Bowl history. The good news for Buffalo is that they've put themselves in a position to win the game. The Bills kicker, Scott Norwood, has an attempt to kick a field goal from 47 yards to win the Bills its first championship. Not an easy kick, but certainly not the hardest.
No good. Wide right.
There are photographers and people all over the field.
Norwood would unfortunately miss the field goal, and the Giants had pulled off an amazing upset win. The following year, the Bills had a chance for redemption by making their way to the Super Bowl again. They finished the regular season with a record of 13-3, but they had to win in a massive defensive struggle in the AFC Championship game to progress to the Super Bowl. They faced Washington.
Okay.
But were blown out early. They were 17-0 down at halftime. They made a game of it towards the end. They ultimately fell 37-24. So that's two Super Bowl losses in 2 years, Tom. It happens. It sucks.
Very unfortunate to have the sort of title of that happening because, as you say, it's not common to have a team get in the Super Bowl twice in a row. To lose twice in a row is probably not something you'd put on a winner's medal.
Next year. And unlike the 1990 and 91 seasons, the Bills were forced to make it to the Super Bowl the hard way in 1992. They limped into the playoffs with an 11-5 record. Jim Kelly, the Bills quarterback for the bulk of the 90s, and he was their most influential player, arguably, he was injured coming into this match. He was replaced with the backup quarterback, Frank Reich. The first game got off to a horror show as they were down 35-3 early in the third quarter.
Wow.
yeah, that's pretty bad.
It's not great.
No, you're asleep.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're not doing anything.
Yeah, you're stunned more than asleep, I guess.
That's a much better way to put it. Mm. Slowly, the wheels began to turn as the Bills scored 4 touchdowns in the third quarter alone and would go on to score 35 unanswered points.
Wow. What year was that again, sorry?
This was 1992.
What a final.
Yeah.
That reminds me of like AC Milan versus Liverpool.
Yeah. With 3 minutes to go, the Bills were up 38-35. And that was their first lead of the game with 3 minutes to go. Like, out of nowhere. They were facing off against the Houston Oilers, and the Oilers managed to kick a field goal to tie the game and then send the game into overtime. Mm-hmm. After what seemed impossible only 30 minutes ago, the Bills kicked a field goal to emerge as victors 41-38. This game is what is known as the comeback.
Yeah, okay.
And the 32-point deficit remains to this day as the largest comeback in NFL history.
Sure.
They kept up this momentum by defeating the Pittsburgh Steelers 24-3 in the divisional round, and then they defeated their rivals, the Miami Dolphins, 29-10 in the AFC Championship game.
Okay.
In the Super Bowl, they faced America's team, the Dallas Cowboys, in Super Bowl 27. They're in for the third year running. And third time's a charm, right?
Of course.
The Bills commit a record 9 turnovers on their way to getting trounced 52-17.
Wow.
They become the first team in NFL history to lose 3 consecutive Super Bowls.
That's crazy.
They've experienced all 3 losses. The first one being the most heartbreaking, where they had a chance to win, they only lost by a point. The second one, blown out early, but in the end it was a comfortable win for Washington, who were never really threatened. And now this one, horror show. Weren't even close.
Yeah.
Didn't even come within a mile of the Dallas Cowboys, who at that time were one of the best teams to ever play in the NFL. It's pretty hard to swallow. Like, the players would be really feeling it at this point.
I mean, I wonder sort of how many players... was it a similar squad for all three? I mean, it would be because it's not a long amount of time.
You get a lot of turnover in the NFL, like the lower-ranked guys only being on 1 or 2 year contracts.
Sure.
But the bulk, their core was pretty much the same.
Wow. So demoralizing. How do you get up and bother again?
One of my favorite quotes of all time in relation to sport is from Ben Cousins, the former West Coast Eagles player, who, when he was talking about when they lost that 2005 grand final against the Swans by only 4 points, he said, "It hurts because you're not guaranteed to get back there the next year."
Yeah, exactly.
So all you do is work to get back to that point, and even then you're not guaranteed to win it.
Yeah.
The Bills weren't done yet, though. In 1993, the Bills were more determined than ever to finally lift the Vince Lombardi trophy and bring the city its first championship. After a regular season record of 12-4, the Bills eased past the LA Raiders and Kansas City Chiefs to set up a rematch with the team that whooped them the year before. America's team, the Dallas Cowboys, which is
the one and only,
which is such a quintessential American thing. Dallas Cowboys.
Everyone knows them around the world.
Exactly. The Bills became the only team to play in 4 straight Super Bowls, and this time they weren't settling for second best. The Bills led 13-6 at halftime and looked poised to get the W.
Yep.
What do you reckon happens, Tom?
I reckon the Cowboys took the lead. And then I think the Dallas Cowboys took the lead, and then they came back and beat the Dallas Cowboys.
The Cowboys would start the half well by forcing a fumble from Bills running back, Thurman Thomas, and they tied up the game 13-13. The Cowboys would then proceed to score the next 17 points of the game to run out 30-13 winners, leaving the Bills and their fans completely stunned. They have just been handed their 4th straight loss in the biggest game of the season.
Wow.
Put yourself in the shoes of the players first. How would you feel, Tom?
Probably numb, to be honest. I think after the 3rd one, 3 is the number where it's just sort of like, this is as bad as it gets. 4th is more like, yep, it's about right. On the one hand, you're a great team, so you are successful. So there's worse things than losing 4 finals, and that's never making the finals. But once you're there, the crushing demoralization of losing 4 in a row is pretty hard to stomach.
It hurts, and the Bills are endlessly taunted to this day with jokes. So, Tom, do you know what Bills stands for? Boy, I love losing Super Bowls.
Now, so you're telling me that they never made... So that it ended after the 4th one, they didn't make the finals.
The Buffalo Bills have not been to a Super Bowl since.
Wow. Poor Buffalo.
But they're getting better the last 2 seasons. The most previous season, they made the AFC Championship game, the game before the Super Bowl.
Yep.
They've got a good team, but one that I don't think can win a Super Bowl, unfortunately.
Can't really put that into context with any other sporting team that I've heard of.
Exactly. A team losing 4.
And to have that as the only time.
And the only time.
Yeah, is really...
And that's why I put it in. It's almost unheard of.
To make 4 in a row, that... that is admirable from the team. That's probably a bigger achievement than winning one final, is making four in a row.
The worst thing about it is that team in the 90s is one of the best teams ever, and it wasn't rewarded with a Super Bowl win.
Mike Bibby can't believe it. Mike Bibby just went to the ground and said, what is happening here? Foul on Christie. His second.
Fast forward to 2002. Okay. We're still in the USA, and we're talking about basketball. Okay. It's game 6 of the Western Conference Finals between bitter rivals, the Sacramento Kings and the LA Lakers.
Okay.
The Kings are currently up in this series 3-2 in a 7-game series.
Yep.
And a win in this game means they advance to their first ever NBA Finals. The Lakers are on the brink of defeat and missing out on the opportunity to achieve a three-peat, winning 3 championships in a row. So both sides are taking different roads to get to this point. The Sacramento Kings have always been the little brother team against the Lakers, who are a media sensation at the time.
Yeah.
The Lakers had Shaquille O'Neal.
Mm-hmm. Kobe.
And the late, great Kobe Bryant, yep, as well, both in their primes.
Yes.
However, this was the first year in the Lakers dynasty that there had been a rift between the players, and Shaq and Kobe were reportedly feuding.
Sure.
The Kings dominated the 2001-2002 regular season. They finished with the league's best record, 61 wins, 21 losses. And this is on the back of ultra-consistent but yet underrated players. You had Mike Bibby, Scott Pollard, Vlade Divac. Mm-hmm. They headed into Game 6 with a lot of confidence. They were the best team in the league. And the team in the East for the Eastern Conference who'd won were the New Jersey Nets, who weren't going to beat either the Kings or the Lakers.
I think it's funny that you say that before as well, the best team in the league, because that's what Sacramento were. Because, as you say, the Lakers maybe got bigger star players, but Sacramento, the best team.
They worked better as the best team.
Yes.
And the New Jersey Nets in the East weren't that great. They were a good side, but they weren't going to beat either the Lakers or the Kings.
Sure.
So effectively, whoever won the Western Conference pretty much won the NBA. What was to follow has been described by many officials, a lot of journalists, as a ripoff and, quote, one of the worst officiated games I have ever seen. You're only allowed to have 6 fouls in a game. If you commit 6 fouls, you're fouled out and can't participate for the remainder of the game. Whilst this isn't horribly uncommon, a few key defensive players were fouled out. Vlade Divac, who is no stranger to fouling out in playoff games, but there are a number of dubious calls against him.
Okay.
Scott Pollard was fouled out after only playing 11 minutes.
Wow. So foul every 2 minutes.
And unlike Divac, Pollard wasn't used to getting fouled out a lot.
So not a given, yeah.
So for him to commit 6 fouls in 11 minutes, it's a bit suspect.
Yeah. That's, do you know the nature of the fouls? I mean,
a lot of them were very technical calls where, like, yeah, okay, you can call it, but you normally, in like a playoff game,
yeah,
you let those.
You let the game run. Yes, yeah, to the detriment of the game when that happens. Sure.
One of the examples that I'm going to give you, the strangest moment was when Mike Bibby, arguably the King's best player, was elbowed in the nose in what should have been an offensive foul on Bryant in plain view of the ref.
Should have been an offensive foul. A big break for the Lakers as Bibby took a shot from Bryant, who now will go to the line. He's 9 for 9.
The Lakers would win 106-102 in a heated affair. It got really heated towards the end of the game, really kind of ugly. With the series tied at 3-all, the Kings went back to Sacramento to win the decider of the series. In heartbreaking fashion, again, the Kings would take the game to overtime, but lose 112-106. This was the most viewed playoff game in the post-Michael Jordan era.
Wow.
I want you to remember that, because that's important later.
Okay.
That's an important detail.
Cool.
The Lakers would go on to sweep the New Jersey Nets 4-0 in the NBA Finals and achieve that three-peat. So you're probably thinking already for the Kings, that's a pretty bad way to lose.
Absolutely.
Like, yeah.
A lot of question marks with officiating and against a team that, look, yeah, you do, the question does come into it. The Lakers are a massive franchise. It's probably in the best interest for the NBA for the Lakers to win. Not to sound cynical, but you do have, you know, the Lakers, especially I remember at that time, massive team.
One of the natural things that supporters like to do after their team loses is to blame the officials.
Yep.
Now, there are many supporters who believe there's a conspiracy behind this game and that the game was manipulated, like you said, Tom, by the NBA for the Lakers. The motive behind this theory is that the Lakers were the hot ticket in town. And in order to boost ratings, sales, merchandise, etc., we need the most recognizable product for our brand being the NBA, playing in the biggest series.
Mm-hmm.
You want the Lakers in the finals. They want to see Shaq and Kobe get the three-peat.
Similar to how you'd have Messi in the final of a Copa America or something.
Unlike most conspiracy theories that are absolute hogwash, there is actually some serious evidence that backs this theory up.
Okay.
So in 2008, over 6 years after the game, former NBA ref Tim Donaghy came out with a document stating that Game 6 of the Western Conference Finals between the Lakers and Kings was fixed. To sum up the document, Donaghy claims that the referee crew were acting in the interest of the NBA and extending the series out to 7 games. The idea behind the fix was that the better team can win in Game 7. So Game 7, according to this report, isn't fixed. Both teams are tied at 3 apiece. The best team will win Game 7 in advance. So, Tom, you're probably wondering, who is Tim Donaghy? How does he know all this?
Yes, I am.
In an FBI investigation 2007, which is how all sentences should start when you're discussing someone.
Yeah.
Donaghy was found to have bet on several matches he officiated, whilst also accepting money from mobsters to influence the number of points in a game. Now, he pled guilty to these crimes. That's important detail.
Yes.
He pled guilty. No contest.
Yep.
He did do these things. And he was sentenced to 8 years in prison. Now, many detractors, including then NBA head David Stern, said that this was the act of a desperate man trying to reduce his sentence any way he could.
Sure.
For Kings fans, this was sort of like vindication. They'd always had their suspicions, and they've now been somewhat confirmed as true. Doesn't change the fact that they still lost.
Yeah, I agree. I think we place more emphasis on it where it's some incredibly huge operation to have the Lakers win behind closed doors. I think, in my mind, a lot of it comes down to as well, almost like a subliminal nature. So the Lakers are the big team, the referee may give a call based on the fact that, in their mind, they're aware of the environment around it, of the Lakers probably being better for the NBA to make the finals. And sometimes calls get made in split seconds based on that premise. It's a similar way to how you'd find a referee that would act at a home game of a home team. Slightly less, like, going to give that call.
I think so, too.
Not a conscious decision, but it's human nature for that to slip sometimes and to be like, oh, maybe not, we're in the home ground, you know, they're going to yell at me. I'm not giving it because of that, but the 50-50 will go 51-49.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah.
The dream comes true!
It's 1988. We're at the French Open, the iconic Roland Garros, and the 17-year-old Natasha Zvereva, representing the Soviet Union, has made it to her first ever Grand Slam final. To reach this point, she has defeated, she had defeated the sixth seed, Helena Suková, in the quarterfinal, and second seed, Martina Navratilova, in the fourth round. So it's been a magical run up until this point. She's done a phenomenal job to get to this point. A 17-year-old as well. It is a dream story. Her opponent is number one in the world, 18-year-old German sensation, Steffi Graf. Now, a little bit of context about Steffi Graf. She would go on to win 22 Grand Slam titles in her career. In 1988, Steffi Graf completed a unique Golden Grand Slam. And this is by winning all 4 Grand Slams of that year and an Olympics gold medal. It took all but 32 minutes for Steffi Graf to defeat Natasha Zvereva 6-love, 6-love. Zvereva only scored 13 points for the entire match. Throughout the game, it became clear the disparity between the two players. Commentators even noted how visibly upset Zvereva was in the second set, especially.
And the way things are going now, 5-love, love 30, this could possibly be the quickest women's final they've had here at Roland Garros ever. And I feel sorry for a young Natalia Zvereva, because she has beaten some good players to get here, but Steffi Graf is not going to give her any margin at all here in the final, and neither she should.
And we've discussed this idea of blowouts before. We spoke about Australia versus American Samoa, 31-0. And I think this is right up there with the most crushing defeats. The entire match is on YouTube. I actually watched the whole thing this morning, And it was over very quickly, and it was just, upsetting to see. There was no fun or entertainment to be had out of it. It was just seeing someone just beat up someone else.
Now, that's interesting, because why do you think there was such a gulf in quality?
Steffi Graf is one of the greatest tennis players of all time.
Okay.
And she was just having a magical run that year.
Sure.
She had just... Undeniable. Graf, she simply just played what has been described as the perfect match. Zareva was just inexperienced, coming against a player who was at the peak of her powers. In the post-match interview and trophy presentation, Zareva was visibly crying and was incredibly emotional. She even apologized to the crowd, saying, "I'm sorry for a bad, like, such a terrible match. I should have put up something better," which is really upsetting. In front of a televised audience as a 17-year-old.
In front of her family, friends.
Zareva, she went on to be a solid player in her own right, consistently being amongst the top 20 female players. But she never reached a Grand Slam final again in her career. The 32 minutes the game took remains the quickest final in the history of tennis.
The Bills returned home as the only American pro team in any sport to lose the championship showdown four consecutive times.
Which was the worst loss, Tom? And just to remind you, we've heard the three stories.
Yep.
Story number one, the Buffalo Bills losing four consecutive Super Bowls. Story number two, the Sacramento Kings Game 6 conspiracy. Or story number three, Zareva with a double bagel in the Roland Garros final.
The tennis one is probably the most heartbreaking, I think. I think that comes a lot down. I don't think it's a coincidence that both players were so young that a situation like that happens. Psychology comes into that a lot as such a young player when you are losing. Particularly when you don't have that experience, you can disintegrate, which sounds like what happened. It sounded like the other player just lost her way and then, you know, basically lost the final. The Lakers one, I think, is more systemic. So it's more down to perhaps there being vested interest by the NBA. As we touched on before, I don't think necessarily that was the reason why. I think there's a lot of conspiracy theories going on, but I do think there's probably something in that more so than it just being a just 50-50 loss. I'm going to go with Buffalo because I think that's the most heartbreaking, because I think it's a testament to them to get to four finals, and I think they deserve to come away with a win in one of those four.
It's a flip of the coin between the other two, and as much as I am a massive fan of American football, it's probably my second favourite sport outside of AFL, I am going to go the Sacramento Kings Game 6 conspiracy, because a lot of the players could sense something wasn't right. That, like, you can't make those calls, or you can't not call blatant fouls. The report didn't come out 6 years later until Tim Donaghy made that document. So they'd had like 6 years to dwell on it and be like, oh, it was just the refs that cost us. And then someone comes up with pretty, while circumstantial, like, it is, like, evidence. Like, he's very accurate on, like, his findings. And to come out, like, 6 years later and then be like, oh, my God, it was a fix.
Mm.
We'll never know.
Yeah.
The worst thing about that loss is that there'll be no resolution. Was it just a really bad night, or was there actually some sort of sinister plot behind it?
I'm not sure where any foul is other than Kobe jumping into defenders who were backing up.
This has been the Right in Front of You podcast, where we look at stories beyond the scoreboard. Thank you.
Here we go. Crowd cheers. Here's Siddle. Oh, well, Marlon's close. He's given him. He's given him. Felix Siddle's got a hat-trick on his birthday.
Steps into it. Pass is caught. Diggs. Sideline. Touchdown. Unbelievable.
Grab some people. They grab some more people.
Seeing the most extraordinary finish here.
Wherever you've been watching this brilliant